51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. At the beginning of Brett Anderson's second memoir, Afternoons with the Blinds Drawn, he says, this is, quote, the book I said I wouldn't write about the things I said I didn't want to talk about. But after the success last year of Coal Black Mornings, his first memoir, which chronicled his childhood, his parents and the beginnings of the band Suede, it seemed inevitable that, yes, Afternoon would follow Morning and that we would have a follow-up with the next chapter of his life. Delighted to have Brett Anderson join us now from studio in Manchester. Did something specific change your mind, Brett, that you would tackle this part of your story that you didn't want to tackle previously?
I think I kind of, there's a couple of things. I think I kind of really enjoyed writing Coal Black Mornings and kind of really enjoyed the whole process of going through that and sort of felt it was kind of really helpful for me actually in lots of ways. I'm just very glad I did it. And so I wanted to write more. It's as simple as that. I couldn't not pick at the scab kind of thing. And then I sort of thought, well, you know, do I want to write the conventional rock autobiography, you know, and I thought, no, I don't want to just write a normal rock autobiography about the kind of same old rubbish that people in bands talk about. So I thought I'd approach it from a slightly different angle. I tried to write a book about kind of looking at myself as almost like a specimen, kind of like, you know, looking at what happened to me, my journey through the kind of like the fame machine, the success machine, and what that did to me as a person, and to try and sort of like lift the kind of, you know, lift the lid on that whole world, really, I suppose, a little bit, you know.
And I guess what's vital to what you're doing, particularly in this section of the memoir, if you like, is where we are in history. We're at the beginning of the 90s. How would you describe the music scene that Suede were coming into at that time?
Oh, I think it was pretty bad, to be honest. It was sort of this awful, dead, kind of slightly worthless scene. But I kind of make the point in the book that every sort of wave of new bands, it's almost their duty to sort of slag off the previous generation of bands, because it's sort of part of the kind of like the continuing kind of thing of birth and rebirth sort of thing that happens with musical scenes. But I think the kind of music scene in the early 90s was particularly dull, to be honest. And I'm not going to kind of get into sort of naming names of other bands, but it was dead. I think that one of the reasons that Suede kind of emerged with so much kind of sort of vitality and aplomb and critical acclaim was because the press was really looking for a band that had a bit of elan and a bit of spirit.
Now, it's interesting that you say there the press was looking for this band. You know, some listeners of a certain age now, younger than possibly you and me, will wonder would they not just go online and find out what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's
very different, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a very, very different world. And anyone that wasn't aware of that world, anyone that's born after that, will kind of slightly struggle to understand the relevance. But there used to be a very voracious and kind of influential weekly music rock press, you know, the Melody Maker, the Enemy, and before that Sounds, and they were very much kind of like very instrumental in kind of making and breaking bands. And that's not to say that they could create success when there was no sort of substance there. You know, they tried a couple of times with bands like Zig Zig Sputnik and stuff like that, and those bands just sort of disappeared. But, you know, but they were very influential gatekeepers, and if you wanted to sort of get anywhere, you had to sort of appeal to those gatekeepers in lots of ways. And there was a kind of very, very sort of you know, kind of like lively, shall we say, weekly debate about music that was going on between the sort of rival publications. And I think that in lots of ways, you know, it was kind of crushing to bands, and in lots of ways it was, in a funny sort of way, creative, because it was part of that Darwinian process that meant that some bands just kind of bothered getting better.
And maybe, you know, more of a symbiosis between the critical world and the performing world.
Yeah, I mean, it's all kind of part of it, isn't it? I kind of think that we've sort of lost something quite valuable. You know, lots of people were very suspicious of the British music press, and every time we went abroad, and people sort of like, you know, threw accusations of hype at us and stuff like that. Mm. But I think that the British music press it sort of did have a sort of valuable role in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and I do think that we've lost something actually since we don't have that. I do think we've lost something.
And of course, Melody Maker, that the famous headline. Let's say before there was even, you had actually released the first single, The Drowners, I think, came out later in 1992. It was early 1992 when Melody Maker said, "The best new band in Britain." I mean, super to see that, I'm sure, for you guys. But did it put a kind of pressure on too?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you know, looking back on these things, we were far too overexposed too early on, and that wasn't. You know, ultimately, with the benefit of hindsight, that wasn't kind of that helpful, you know what I mean? But, I mean, the music, you know, the media generally, it's amoral. It doesn't have kind of like, there's no sort of centralised figure that's sort of like making kind of, with a moral compass that's saying, oh, we mustn't do this too much of this band because they might get overexposed, blah, blah, blah. It's like, it's just people just getting excited about what we were doing. You know, we were doing something different against the grain that spoke to them. You know, we were writing great songs and we had an attitude and all of those things. And the press just got excited about it and possibly overexcited, and you can look at it like that. But it's a part of our story. I'm not particularly proud of it as an element of our story, because I think people are suspicious of the involvement of the press, because they feel as though they're being manipulated. And I think all that happened was, in our case, was that we were doing something exciting, fresh, and we were doing it very well, and the press just got excited about that, and that's what happened.
And The Drowners, that single, was it already written when you saw that headline? Because it was released later that year. It must have been you'd probably been performing it around the place at that point.
Oh yeah, and I mean that was, you know, that was sort of 2 weeks before the song was actually released. So yeah, we've been playing that for a year and a half. Yeah, so I mean that's the kind of interesting thing. You know, we were all of those early songs that people got very excited about in the early days. We'd been playing them to two people in pubs for at least a year before that, and everyone had, you know, had, and they'd been met with a kind of like a shrug of indifference by the whole British music scene, because it was out of step with what was going on, and we were kind of writing these very sort of like neurotic, intense, dramatic songs about British life when it was when things like shoegazing and Madchester and all of these movements were fashionable, and it didn't fit into that particular kind of model, and it took a while for the press to catch up with us, I think, and you know, that was an interesting thing as well.
One of the big breakthroughs, of course, was slightly later on, Animal Nitrate. And you say at one point in the memoir being what we're speaking about, Afternoons with Blinds Drawn, you say, Brett, that you kind of felt that you were kind of hiding in full sight, if you like. You were doing things that people weren't noticing. What was it specifically about Animal Nitrate that you think was this idea of hiding in plain sight?
Well, it was, you know, that was a kind of slightly mischievous, because it was an interesting song, because it sort of smuggled this very, very sort of dark themes into the mainstream. You know, the song is about drugs and sexual abuse, and it's a very murky, murky song. But the fact is, it's got this very hummable hook line. And so it was kind of A-listed by Radio 1, so that always kind of like amused me, you know. And I love the fact that was played along, you know, next to Take That Records, you know, and people were sort of humming it and sort of, oh, this is a nice little tune. There was something that amused me about that. I don't really know why, I just did, you know.
Just as you say, you know, it amused you that Animal Nitrate had this very hummable tune, Brett Anderson. Did you ever see anybody humming or hear anybody humming that tune that you thought, you don't have a clue what we're singing about in that song?
Of course, yeah. It's, you know, that's the beauty of pop music, isn't it? It's sort of multi-layered. You can look at it on like any kind of good art form. There's different sort of levels you can look at it at, you know. I remember once this kind of, I was walking down the street and there's this sort of like load of kids in London. They said, oh, there's that bloke from that band. And they were going, la da 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 da. I mean, they just heard the tune. They're like, that's the thing about pop music. It has to work as a good melody, Otherwise, it doesn't work, because that's what it is. It has to have that sort of superficiality. And if there's layers beyond that, then that's all well and good.
The other thing that the press, maybe the press outpouring may put a type of pressure on you, that people kind of maybe wanted to hate you. You tell some great stories in the memoir about the reactions of particular audiences. One in Glasgow, I'm not sure if I would have wanted to be at this gig if I were a member of Suede. And it gives us the title for one of the chapters, in fact. Do you remember the heckle that was thrown at you?
Yes, a feat Southern Wankers, yeah. It was a particularly kind of frosty kind of reception that we had in Glasgow. It was exactly the time. So the Melody Maker cover had just come out, proclaiming us to be the best new band in Britain. Blah blah blah, and then we were touring, and I think lots of places in the UK were suspicious of us because they'd chosen to see us as a sort of product of the press, I suppose. And they were kind of, you know, there were a couple of gigs where we were just sort of like playing to a whole lot of stony faces that just sort of like, you know, were a bit sort of like cynical about us. And that was one of them, but it was kind of a particularly amusing night. And some guy just sort of like, you know, shout, "Hey, it's Southern Wankers." And I thought it was a brilliant heckle, because it was sort of like, it just so sort of like quite eloquent and quite sort of quite ironic. In lots of ways.
Yeah, so. It must be something about the word "effete" in a Glaswegian accent that
exactly.
added something to it.
I just always remembered it, and so I put it in the book because I thought it was funny.
But mind you, Matt Osmond, the bass player, maybe he doesn't have quite such happy memories. I think he was genuinely frightened when he came out of he'd gone to the toilet after the gig, hadn't he?
It was a kind of threatening evening, and we were kind of, you know, there was sort of a whole gang of sort of blokes that, you know, just didn't like us, and but that was, you know, that's part of, you know, you, if you talk to any bands that are just starting, that kind of sense of threat and that sense of confrontation is really important. You know, you look at, you, if you, you know, you kind of like look at some of those early punk gigs, you know, with the Pistols, and you know, there was a very confrontational thing, and I kind of quite like that. That's, you know, that confrontational element with the audience, where you're almost, it's almost like a, there's something a little bit hostile about it. It makes it exciting, you know, it makes it exciting.
But you also talk about great gigs, Brett, where you felt something was happening. You felt there was a moment happening in front of your eyes. There's one particular one in Southampton you mentioned singing in Belfast. You were singing in the Europa Hotel, which was famous for all the wrong things at that time in history. But you mentioned how the Belfast fans started singing the songs back at you, which is very typical on this island. And one gig that I know you've great memories of, the Tivoli in Dublin in March 1993, which was just ahead of the release of the self-titled debut album, Suede. What are your memories of that?
Yeah, I remember the ferry journey to Dublin. That's what I remember. That this is sort of the days before we could kind of afford plane travel, and I remember kind of being in some transit van on the ferry going to Dublin. And it's kind of like it's very, very low rent. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was the early days, and it was very, very exciting.
There was also, you know, the band was beginning to make strides, beginning to make a mark at this stage, certainly as we get into 1993, and around this time it would have been where with the magazine Lime Lizards that you made that infamous statement that you were a bisexual man who's never had a homosexual experience. Looking back on that statement now, what do you think about it?
Well, I go into it quite a lot of detail in the book, because it's a sort of, I suppose it was a clunky statement, and it was a kind of an ill thought out statement, because what I sort of regret about it isn't the statement itself, it's my misunderstanding of how the media would deal with that statement. And what the media tend to do, is take statements out of context, and then they're open to misinterpretation because you don't have the sort of backstory that kind of goes into the detail of why you made them. But I think what I was trying to express was kind of what you'd call in 2019 you'd call sort of like gender fluidity.
Yeah.
And even though in those days we didn't have the phrase to use, I suppose I was trying to express that. I wasn't trying to put myself in a camp. I was trying to sort of like, strangely enough, kind of like divorce myself from any sexuality in a funny sort of way. You know, I was trying to say I don't want to be put into any of these categories. And ironically, of course, I was put into a very specific category. But
and was that part of that androgyny, that kind of, if you like, asexual isn't the right term, but I know what you're saying. You didn't want to be labelled in those terms. Was that part of the image then the persona that you developed for the band?
I mean, partly, but not consciously. It was a genuine thing. It's that, you know, it certainly wasn't part of the zeitgeist then, like it is now. It feels as though the issues that we were talking about in 1992 have now strangely become part of the zeitgeist. But like I say, we didn't have the language to describe it in those days. We didn't have the term sexual fluidity. We didn't have these issues, and now it's very much part of the kind of like the current debate about sexual politics, and rightly so, you know. It was interesting because we were talking about these things a long time ago when the prevalent zeitgeist was kind of like quite a laddish sort of attitude to sexuality, you know, especially when you had Britpop and Cool Britannia and all these sorts of things. And we sort of stayed firm there, and we didn't become part of that laddish movement, which I'm kind of quite proud of, you know.
You said at the beginning of our chat, Brett, that you found writing the first of the memoirs, Cold Black Morning, you found it helpful, but you still wanted to go back and pick at the scab. There's a real frank honesty and openness in the chapter, a few chapters in and around We Love, We Tire, We Move On. It's all about, you know, Bernard Butler's departure from the band and how your relationship as friends, even, never mind as colleagues, began to really fracture. In fact, you say, in the middle of the chapter, it's almost as if you stop writing and say, I'm finding this chapter really hard to write. That's a direct quote, I think.
Breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah. There you go. Or whatever you do when you're breaking the cover of the book. clearly, it was difficult to write about. What do you think made it so difficult, and have you kind of put something to rest by writing about it?
Well, I think talking about anything is kind of helpful, isn't it? You know, just sort of you're just organising your emotions. What therapy is, isn't it? All you're doing is sitting there and talking about something, and that somehow helps you sort of understand it. So, in one sense, but it's an ongoing thing that I feel as though I felt as though I needed to talk about, because it's still, you know, that whole chapter haunts me. I think when we're young, musicians especially, you know, musicians are sort of impetuous and quixotic and make crazy decisions, and especially when they become successful and they become famous and money gets involved and all of these sorts of things get involved, it kind of magnifies the whole process. And, you know, we didn't have the tools to deal with what was going on. We didn't have the emotional kind of, like, knowledge to be able to deal with it, you know.
Yeah, you were young at the time, now. To be fair.
Yeah, and that's part of the kind of, you know, the soap opera of these things. That's why they're so intriguing to people, because it's always on the point of sort of falling apart, of exploding, of kind of, like, you know, going off.
Would you have spoken to Bernard about the writing of that chapter in particular, or, you know, run things past him, or did you just say, no, look, I'll put it down as I saw it?
I mean, I kind of had this sort of policy about writing both of these books where I kind of contacted everyone and said, look, I'm going to write these books, but you needn't worry that I'm going to... you know, I'm not going to be salacious about any of these things. It's going to be a very kind of considered, respectful... investigation into what happened, sort of thing, and I didn't want to get into the situation where I was kind of like seeking approval from people, because I think that kind of limits what you can do as a writer, and you're always going to be self-conscious, and you're going to end up with a kind of like sanitized version of your book. So I didn't want to get into that with any of the people that actually appear in the book. But I tried to be respectful all the time.
Just a couple of things I'd like to go to before we finish up. Towards the end of the book, you talk about a keyboard player who insisted on having 24-hour access to roast lamb. I mean, if this is a work of fiction, you'd say, he's gone too far there. But this was a real writer.
That's right, yeah, it was. It's one of those kind of bizarre, absurd little moments in kind of making records where we hired this big shot LA keyboard producer, and part of the stipulation of his contract was 24-hour access to roast lamb. I just thought it was just utterly absurd, and kind of it amused me. But I kind of wanted to put those little details into the book, because those are the kind of things that are sort of always behind the headlines. You know, I didn't want to just sort of talk about the same. You know, the Suede story has been very well trodden over and over again, and bloody, bloody, blah. And it's my intention with the book to sort of like to sort of kind of weave in the little details that only I could know about, or only the band could know about, and to try and do it in a sort of interesting way that kind of made it real. It's sort of like detail is very important to me. I've been obsessed with detail in songwriting. And I always think if you get detail right, it gives the work a kind of truth. And I hopefully I did that with the book as well.
Well, when you name one book morning and you may name the second book afternoon, then there must be a detail that evening will come and arrive at some point. And this section of the memoir afternoons with blinds drawn brings us up to basically 2003 and the end of that manifestation of Suede. Is there another one?
Not yet.
Do you think there will?
I have no idea. I mean, I didn't even think that I'd write the second one, so I can't really say.
Yeah.
And I think I'd need a lot of space from it, because I think that, you know, I can write about things that happened to me 25 years ago, because it's almost like writing about a different person. I certainly couldn't write with the same degree of objectivity about my recent life, so it'd have to be
a little bit forward.
And I'd have to find some sort of entry point. I don't know.
Let's finish.
I haven't got any plans to write now.
Right, not at this moment anyway.
Exactly.
But you're allowed to change your mind.
Exactly.
I think you'd make many people happy if you did. But let's finish up by listening to something from coming up. And I suppose we haven't got to the point of discussing when Richard Oakes came in following Bernard's departure, and how that changed the songwriting process for you, Richard, and yourself, probably more of a collaborative force.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit maybe about Trash and how that manifested itself in that.
Yeah, I mean, Trash is a really, really important song for me, because it's, you know, I think it was a very important song for Richard as well, because it was the first sort of the first song that was released as a sort of comeback after Bernard had left and after Richard had joined the band. And, you know, we wrote it I wrote the lyrics as a kind of almost like a sort of like a band anthem almost. It was supposed to sort of be kind of defining the characteristics of what it was like to be a Suede person, I suppose, in inverted commas, and therefore by extension what it's like to be a Suede fan. It still has a power for me, and I still love playing it live.
Brett Anderson, thanks very much for speaking to us this evening.
Thank you so much.
Trash from Suede's third album coming up. And before that, we were talking to Brett Anderson about his memoir Afternoons with the Blinds Drawn, which is published by Little Brown.